Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and now we introduce you to our weekly special guest for the month of August. In June, when we started this series, we had Time Magazine's Baghdad Bureau Chief, Bobby Ghosh, come on each week. In July, Jen Chung, editor of Gothamist. And now we begin a series of appearances for the month of August with New York Times sports columnist William Roden. Roden writes not just about the games, but about the intersection of sports and the rest of society. In his column on Sunday, for example, he described baseball commissioner Bud Selig as kind of like a patient waiting for a root canal as he watched Barry Bonds go for the all-time home run record, and we will pick it up from there. Roden is also author of the recent book, $40 Million Slaves, The Rise, Fall, and Redemption of the Black Athlete, published by Crown, just out in paperback. Hi, Bill. Thanks for doing August with us. Welcome to WNYC.
Hey, Brian. How are you?
All right. Now, you went to the Baseball Hall of Fame inductions.
Yes.
In Cooperstown last weekend. Cal Ripken and Tony Gwynn being entered. And out of curiosity, you wrote, to see if they would rail against steroids at this Barry Bonds moment. And what happened?
They didn't. You know, I mean, you know, Tony was very nice. I mean, I guess that's why they're these two nice guys, you know. And Tony went all the way back to his childhood and all that. Ripken did kind of come close in that he was really heavy on the game and how my legacy, meaning Ripken, is about giving back to the kids and playing this game the way it should be played. And so it was really feel-good moment, and it was, if people haven't gone to Cooperstown.
Is that feel-good moment, or is that sanctimonious?
Borderline. He didn't quite cross that line, but see, here's the thing, you know, and I guess because I've been in this business, and we've both been in this business for so long, I keep telling my colleagues, because we're so desperate for these heroes, and they're starting to bring these, the platitudes, and I said, listen, don't name buildings after these people. We do that all the time. We were doing it with Mark McGwire. All these, they were writing books. Oh, Paul Bunyan. I said, listen, cut it out. Let's just take it for the guy hits home runs, because we got the commissioner's report getting ready to come out, the Mitchell Commission.
Right. George Mitchell.
The George Mitchell.
Former senator from Maine and Senate Majority Leader, and he's studying the steroids problem for Major League Baseball.
And yes, and then there, and so the other shoe's about to drop, and there was a kid, the former Mets clubhouse employee, who said he had a whole network of people he was selling drugs and amphetamines on. So I said, listen, let's just forget this stuff, because then we'll be 2 months later, we didn't know. So it was nice. If you haven't been to Cooperstown, you should go, but, you know.
But that means taking a skeptical stance toward even those who appear to be pure as the driven snow, like Cal Ripken and Tony Gwynn, saying, who knows what these guys are doing that might be dirty. Is that how you want us to see all our professional athletes?
Well, I just think that we need to look at this very clearly. Cal Ripken is he's a good guy. And frankly, sports writers will tell you, we spend 20 minutes in the locker room, for the most part, with these guys. And everybody's on their best
behavior.
After
the game, you mean?
After the game, before the game. You know, in baseball, you can visit with players up to an hour before the game, then after the game, then during the week and all that kind of stuff. It's not like, you know, our kids are in Jack and Jill together or that Jack and Jill, that's a
Black kids.
Yeah, so I guess all I'm saying, I'm just saying we've been burned so many times in this pursuit of heroism and idealism, then you find out that, wow, you mean the guy's human after all? And let's just deal with what he's done for the game, but let's forget this stuff about making them, you know, to the left hand of God.
Now, Bonds is one homer away from Hank Aaron's career record of 755, and you describe it as, quote, what is being portrayed nationally, at least, as a joyless pursuit of history. Is it being portrayed differently at any local level?
In San Francisco. I mean, it's unbelievable.
Where he plays.
Yeah, in San Francisco, if you go to the ballpark in San Francisco, you think that this controversy doesn't exist. You know, it's almost like you're in Oz. You know, and it's really
fascinating. People have said that about San Francisco.
I love San Francisco. Yeah. I mean, it's surreal and it's appropriate. But
and I'm just kidding. But do you think that would be the case no matter where he played. If he was playing in Milwaukee, then they would love him there and hate him everywhere else, or St. Louis or Brooklyn or whatever.
If Brian Cashman had the guts.
New York Yankees general manager.
If Brian Cashman had the guts to bring Barry Bonds to the Yankees to be the designated hitter, I guarantee you there would be a little outcry for about, you know, a couple weeks. But after this guy starts leading him to the promised land and hitting home runs, we always find a way to rationalize. Well, yeah, but, you know, that's Barry. You know, same way they did with Reggie. And I think that that's kind of the way sports tend to be. They love him in San Francisco. Milwaukee would be a little tough sell, I think, but because of Hank Aaron, whose record he's about to break. But I think anywhere else, I think that what you say is true. He'd be a hero.
What's your own feeling about it? Do you have a sense of joy as you watch Bonds make this run?
I enjoy history. I'm a historian. I mean, I love history. If I had more patience, I'd be a historian, but I'm a journalist. You know? But
first rough draft.
Yeah, first draft of history. And I love history, and I love these historic moments. And I think that those people who are getting sucked into this, oh, there's no joy, and I'm not going to like the record. I think you're cheating yourself, because you don't get to hit seven. We talked about this a couple of weeks. You don't get to hit 755 home runs. You don't get to average 23 points a game over a 10-year career in the NBA, or gain 5 yards per carry. And you don't get to do that unless you're fantastic. And I think that steroids, this is a great moment. This is a historic moment. I think I'm not telling people to go out on the street and celebrate it, but you got to give this guy credit. You may not like him, but what he's doing is a monumental feat.
And he's by far the greatest in the context of his era. And if that means it's an era in which, you know, a third of the guys were doing steroids, well, Barry Bonds saw McGuire and Sosa doing it and being lauded, and he wanted in on the action. This is the storyline that we generally hear. But even if that's what happened, he made more of it than anyone else.
And if you, let's say for the sake of argument, if we'll call this the quote-unquote steroid, first of all, we don't know who was doing what. But there were people who were throwing him the ball who were taking the same stuff.
We know pitchers have gotten caught.
People who are catching the ball, the outfielders. So, I mean, you know, I think that we just should just let that go.
New York Times sports columnist William Roden, my guest on WNYC. And obviously everybody's talking about Bonds and steroids, Michael Vick and dogfighting, and NBA ref Tim Donaghy and game fixing. But you had a much more intriguing story to me than any of those last week about the great New York Jet Curtis Martin, a star who stayed out of the limelight, who's now retiring, and who always considered his playing days a kind of training to be an owner in the NFL. I didn't know that until I read your piece. And I don't think I've ever heard of a professional sports star who looked at his career that way. Talk about Curtis Martin.
Yeah, Curtis Martin is just a great, great guy. And you're right, I didn't really know that about Curtis either, about that he wanted to be an owner. But now when you hear him say that my whole career was basically an internship for being an owner, I was studying the owners, I was studying ownership. I said, wow, it makes sense. And to be honest, he kind of played it the right way. When you're a professional athlete, and Tiki Barber did the same thing relative to broadcasting, you've got so much leverage as a player, because when you're playing, the answer is always yes. If you want to do an apprenticeship, if you want to do TV, so. But, you know, it's funny, I was telling you off. The funny thing is, you know, Curtis is a great guy. But now I'm getting an email. I write this, you know, comment about Curtis, great guy. And then some guy emails me, yeah, you know, he's a sellout. You know, he's just kissing up to owners.
Can't win. If he does become an NFL owner, what would that mean for football or for America?
You know, and he had a very good take on that. He said, you know, it's about possibility. It's here I mean, Curtis lived a really tough life in Pittsburgh, and he's what you would have called at 18 a knucklehead by his own description. He said, I wasn't the kind of guy you'd want to invite to dinner. You know, I was a knucklehead, but I found my way. I found the light. And to me, that's what, Brian, I mean, that's what all this stuff is about, is redemption. It's kind of not where you begin, but it's how you end up and how you progress and transform along the way. And Martin, I think, is a brilliant example of, you know, of that. And I think he'd be a great owner. And I asked, well, how would you deal with a Michael Vick, by the way? You know,
good question.
You know, and he said, well, you know, I wouldn't just cast him aside. I mean, I'd I wouldn't say guilt before innocence, but clearly he's the face of the organization, and he'd have to be held accountable.
And he didn't just say he wouldn't cast him aside. He took a position, I guess, against what the league has actually done, because Martin told you he wouldn't suspend Michael Vick, which is exactly what the NFL has done because of these dogfighting charges.
Yeah, which I thought was pretty interesting. He said he wouldn't suspend him, but he would let justice serve his course. But I think what he was saying as a player, and I think we all have to understand this, because this is a world that none of us really understand. It's kind of like trying to understand what it's like to be the president of the United States.
Mm. You know, to be Michael Vick, this huge superstar
quarterback. To be a kid who one day is in Newport News, Virginia, with no money, and then literally the next day signing a $20 million contract. And a lot of people, I think, in society feel that once you make this kind of money, suddenly that transforms you into this kind of, you know, and what?
Well, Curtis, you have a great quote from Curtis Martin: "Society equates money with maturity."
And tell what he says. He says, "I thought it was a great."
He says, "I've got it." He says, "Society feels that if you have material things, there is no way in the world you should do this or that. But money gives you more of an opportunity to do what you would normally do."
Yeah.
Great thought.
Yeah, so you're thinking, so if I'm like 19, 20, I grow up fighting dogs. So when I get somebody, I say, guess what? We can really do it now.
We can get the best dogs.
We get the biggest. And I think that, of course, now I think Curtis understands, wow, this was a pretty big mistake. And I guess what we're trying to do is just don't get, I just got an 8-week-old Australian Shepherd. I mean, I love dogs and that kind of stuff, but let's not get carried away with this stuff. I mean, there are certain people who, you know, see dogs. I mean, everybody sees dogs differently, you know?
And you came out strong against this whole thing, and you hope this sheds a light on this whole world of cruelty to animals in the name of so-called sport. But you had another column on the Michael Vick case recently in which you refer to the NFL's new commissioner, Roger Goodell, as a law and order commissioner. What does that mean? Compared to what in the world of pro football?
Well, compared to even his predecessor, Paul Tagliabue, who was the predecessor. And for example, we've got a Hall of Fame class coming in now. Michael Irvin is one of the people going into the Hall of Fame. Now, Michael Irvin, Dallas Cowboys wide receiver, you know, if you look at his bio, I mean, he did a lot of kind of ugly things, a lot of off the field, some drugs, some this and that. Well, if he were coming around now, under this climate, he would not have the opportunity to be redemptive. You know, he'd be gone. You know, one mistake, kind of you're out of here. So I think that Goodell wants to come in. He wants to impress the owners to let them know that, you know, I'm gonna kick people out the pool.
Yeah. And so you think there's another way he could be going on Vic, which is innocent until proven guilty. Not until then do you lose your job.
I tend to like that. I mean, I tend to like innocence before guilty. I think that's what our justice system is built on. But see, when you're dealing with, particularly now, there's so much heat.
It's image and marketing, isn't it?
And particularly on a league, Brian, that's 70% black. 70 to 80% of the players in the NBA are African-American. Same thing with the NBA, where 90 to 95% of the people who are watching it, the corporations. So I think there is an element, and David Stern deals with this too. There's an element of, well, let's kind of let them know that we're keeping all this in line, that we're keeping this stuff in line. So I don't like that part of it, but that's realistic.
But you wrote that you hope the case doesn't become a referendum on the behavior of African-American athletes. Do you think it can generalize that way rather than be about Vic the individual?
I just pulled up some stuff. I was reading The Wires, as I normally do, and there was a woman, a clerk, in this little town where Vic's home is, and she was starting to get all this nasty, an African-American woman, who was getting all this nasty email. Talking about one guy in particular said, why don't you people learn how to act and let the white race, you know, that kind of nonsense.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, there are a lot of people who don't make these things because a league is 80% black, and that may be their only contact with African-Americans. They will go from Michael Vick to, wow, this is horrible across the board, to, look, here they go again. What do they do with, you know, that kind of stuff? And I would love for the federal government to let's eradicate, you know, dog for animal fighting. Unfortunately, Brian, I see them, you know, taking Michael Vick in the middle of town, you know, and kind of hanging him in effigy. It's okay. That's it.
History repeating itself. Yeah. You know what? We weren't going to take phone calls today on a short segment. We have Richard Gere waiting in the wings to talk about the Dalai Lama coming to New York. But I want to take one phone call, sneak in here, Lazarus in Harlem, who I think is a steroid libertarian. Lazarus?
Yeah. Hi. How are you doing?
Hi. Real quick.
Yeah, I mean, basically, people never do the things that you ask them to do. So tell them that, hey, you guys, use the steroids. Use what you want to do. Let's see how much of a big improvement it's going to be. If you want to kill yourself while you're doing it, sure. But let's see if it's going to improve the records, if it's going to improve the times. And if not, forget about it.
Why, have you ever considered that position?
Well, that's a good point. But see, in sports, you don't have to do that. You don't have to open that door to tell them to do it. Because these competitive athletes, they had a poll once, and it said, if you knew, if it was between taking steroids and dying when you're 35, but winning an Olympic gold medal, would you do it? And overwhelmingly, the athlete said, I'd do it.
Really?
So I see what you're saying, Lazarus, but I wouldn't.
Because they're put up against the wall, really, by a competitive environment that determines their success or failure, right?
And anything, any edge. I mean, we talk about back in Willie Mays' era, they had this little thing called red juice, which was some kind of energy thing. And everybody almost was using uppers, amphetamine. So
it wasn't pomegranate.
It was.
But I wanted to answer one sports question before you go. One really interesting thing that you wrote about attitudes toward Michael Vick, the athlete, before the whole dogfighting thing, that great as he is on the field, he has had many critics because of what you call a deeply rooted cultural bias against athleticism.
Yeah, and that position.
What does that mean?
Well, what that means is that historically, the quarterback position, going back to the day when it was a single wing, when your best athlete was the – historically, people feel that the quarterback should be this kind of – lumbering kind of guy who stands tall in the pocket and takes the punishment and, you know, that kind of John Wayne, the American hero kind of stuff. And what people like Vic are these guys who are these great athletes who get out of Dodge, who can run. And they're the people, they're a group of people who just don't think that's the way you play quarterback.
Well, if there can be a bias against athleticism and professional athletics, then I guess anything is possible. But as John Kruk once said when he was playing baseball, we're not athletes, we're ball players.
What does that mean?
We'll have to ask John Kruk. I have no idea. William Roden, New York Times sports columnist, is our weekly guest for the month of August. He'll be here every Thursday this month. Bill, see you next week. Thanks
all right,
a lot.
Man, my pleasure. Take care.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, Richard Gere on the Dalai Lama coming to town in a minute.